Welcome to the All In, All Out podcast. My name is Shannon Ross, founder and executive director of The Community. This podcast is focused on the goal of creating a justice system more worthy of that name and why you, no matter who you are, should care. The name of the podcast refers to the fact that we must be all in and go all out to truly address the way justice is viewed and applied in America. Furthermore, the sense of separation the system imposes is an illusion. What happens to individuals on both sides of the fence is connected and tied to the same fate. How we treat incarcerated people reflects the state and direction of society. Those inside are all out, and those of us outside are all in. As for me, I am no more than a dreamer who knows there is a better way and is devoted to reaching out and holding on, even when it is uncomfortable, because connections and empathy are the foundation of the types of strong, healthy communities that we all want. I spent 17 years in the Wisconsin prison system, where I obtained my bachelor's degree in business administration, had several articles published locally and nationally, co-created a mental health program that now exists in several facilities throughout the state, and founded The Community. Upon release at the end of 2020, I obtained my master's degree in sustainable peacebuilding at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, co-founded a successful multidimensional justice solutions firm called Paradigm Shift, became a first-time father, and I am currently a consultant at Marquette University's Higher Education and Prison Program. But these achievements have occurred alongside numerous and constant failures. Therefore, I, and however, remain all in and all out. This week, Adam and I spoke about our trip to the world's only nonprofit prison in Belize.
The initial impetus for the Belize trip started when I was incarcerated, and my cellie at the time, Jeremy, and he was telling me that somebody he knew who had gotten out, this is when we were in Stanley, 2012, 2013, he was like, yeah, you can travel outside the country. He's like, you just need to have the judge's permission. And me knowing nothing about anything at the time, I'm like, oh, okay. That's what's so interesting is I was told early on before getting out something that made me release, assuming it was possible. Whereas most people got out, and it seems they were under the assumption that definitely not, that you can travel, right? So it was sometime last year, early summer, I don't even know what caused it, but I was like, hey, I'm going to try this now. And so I emailed, I could probably look and see when the email was, but I emailed Neil, and I said, what's the process for travel? Is it possible? He's like, yeah. And right away, you know, Neil's pretty good about responding, at least with me. And he says, here's the form, and here's where you submit the form. And I never submitted it because it was like an online thing I didn't have an account for, but I filled it out. And I didn't just do that, though. I asked, I think, some of this I'm kind of is lost on me right now, some of the levels and steps that were taken. But I started to work, I think, with Jim on our team because I know he's a legal beagle. And I was just like, hey, this is what we're doing. Yeah, I forget what happened. I submitted it, but I submitted it super basic because the form says, what is your reason for travel? That's all it is, right? It just says, like, where you're going, sign it, what's your reason for travel? So I'm not thinking I have to make a whole argument as to why I'm traveling and why it's something that's important. I'm just thinking, oh, I'm going to Belize for this reason. So I submitted it. And before I did that, though, I posted on Facebook. I remember, like, it was one of my more active posts. A lot of people were, like, commenting about, I think I said something about, like, I'm going to try and travel. Has anyone done that? Or I don't know what it was. So I got, like, an agent came on there. I don't even know who it was. Somebody apparently who I'm connected to and says, I didn't even know you could do this. Like, this agent was learning through my Facebook post that you can travel. And other people were like, I've done it before. I think somebody else might have came on and said, this is what you do. I had one person I knew inside hit me up, DM on a messenger and say that, hit me up. So I call him. And he's like, because he did like 20 some years. He was on a parole. He's like, man, you don't even need to go through all of that. So you just get permission from your agent. You can go. And right away, I'm like, this sounds like one of those things that people say because they're not really informed on what they're doing.
That's terrifying.
And so I listened to him. This individual told me that he had traveled to Israel and Dominican Republic without any contact from the judge whatsoever. He just, like, talking to his agent. His agent was like, I mean, sure, I guess. I don't see why you can't. His agent was completely unaware of what the process was. So the agent signed off on it, and he'd just go. And I think one of the agents that you're connected to kind of got wind of what the process was and what I was being told. And they were like, yeah, tell Shannon that's not a thing. Like, tell Shannon that you absolutely, because she was more aware of the process. And she was like, you absolutely need to have the judge to sign off on that. Anybody traveling outside the country with just their agent's approval is risking, like, you know, some legal ramifications that will have them go back to prison, basically. So I went through the process. I think you were trying to find out if the process was similar for you. It was like this whole long, maybe 8 months before we actually started going on it. But I think some of that I'm missing, because I know it was like so many stages where I submitted. I didn't hear anything back for like 3 weeks. I texted Judge Ashley, who at the time was a deputy chief, and I was just like, hey, do you know who's on mic? Who's hearing my case? I just wanted to find out from him. Like, not, I wasn't going to ask Judge Ashley for help, because I know that he was the, you know, deputy chief judge, I think it was. And he's like, yeah, oh, Judge Kies is on your case. And I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, you got the decision back, right? I'm like, no, I wouldn't be asking you who's on there if I got the decision back. He's like, well, that's disappointing. He says, you were denied. And I'm like, huh, okay, well, can you give me the reason? And he says, yeah. He forwarded me the decision. So I read it, and it was super parole-y, right? Like, it was, hasn't served sufficient time, like, type of thing. Like, there was no more information as to what the issue was. And I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So Judge Ashley kind of, you know, said, I can't get involved, but you can put in an appeal. You can, you know, it's a motion. You can appeal the decision. So just go do that. So I went to talk to Jim, because I know, again, Jim is, as much as he can, you know, be a rain on your parade person at times about stuff, he's giving you, like, you know, there's good advice in, and a lot of reasoning behind why he can be cynical about some things. And so he kind of told me what I should put in there. You know, he's like, you should have done this, you should have done that. I'm like, that's great, but I didn't. So, like, let's do this now. And he helped me put together an argument as to why going to Belize was a good thing and why they should appeal it, approve it. So I did that. I sent it to Judge Kies again. One of the things I realized in the process of this is they were sending responses and decisions why I wasn't getting it on the e-filing system. I don't have an account, right? I'm not an attorney. So I remember when I was in one of the hearings later, I was telling Judge Kies, I'm like, I'm not getting these. Like, I didn't know there was an appointment coming up, or I didn't know you all wanted this information for one of these hearings. And one of the secretaries of the people in the courtroom at the time was like, well, we sent it to you on the e-filing system. So Judge Kies is like, he doesn't have an e-filing account. You have to send this to him physically at, like, wherever he's at if you want him to get it. So that kind of clarified why some of that was. In the end, what was really interesting is that not only did, like, no one know, it seemed, right? Neil gave me the information, that one agent who found out about it, that, you know, gave me some advice in along the lines of, this is exactly what you have to do. You better do that part. But it didn't seem like it, when I talked to, you know, to the previous chief judge who was in at the time, she wasn't really aware of the process. Just so many people were not aware of how you go about traveling outside the country. So many people know because nobody asks, apparently. And I know when I asked on my Facebook page and when I was in the group chat I have with various advocates and organizers across the state, I was like, I'm going to try this thing. And they're like, oh, you can't do that. And I'm like, I mean, I don't know. Like, we'll see. And then, so at the same time, you were trying to find out how you do it because you were under parole. And the statute that I was going under very clearly said, you have to get permission from the judge. You are not able to travel outside the country as a rule of extended supervision, but they didn't seem to apply to parole. So, like, we were like, does this even apply to you at all? Is there a different way you have to go about it? And that's where things got even trickier. Because Neil was like, I really don't even know now. Like, Neil didn't have an answer for that one at all. And I think in the end, you know, you filed the same way I did and filed it up your way. But yeah, it took, God, I probably should look to see exactly how long the process was from starting, getting the information to actually filing. And there was a delay in there, right? I could have probably done it in 2 weeks. But I was just, it was just like reaching out to different people to make sure, like, is this how I do this? Can I actually do this? So what became obvious in the process of getting approval for this is that the reference letters I had to have, the people I had to reach out to find out, the help I had crafting, you know, my appeal, the fact that I was, like, Facebook friends with the actual judge, even though we've never communicated, which was interesting, those are not easy things or the regular person is going to have, right? Like, so it was the whole goal in the very beginning for me to do this was to create an avenue and a path that other people could, that were on paper, could travel, right? That was the whole reason. I really wasn't looking to just like find excuses to travel. I genuinely wanted to find a way to say, this is how you do this if you do want to travel, right? And what became obvious in the end is that this is not a common thing. This is not an easy thing that most people are going to be able to get approved for, right? And so that was the unfortunate part about it that was like, I feel wasn't a win in the end. But at least I have the information now. At least I can provide that for people and say it's doable, but maybe not the easiest thing to do.
While I was incarcerated, I never really thought about international travel because I thought it was just a hard no. I didn't even think it was worth exploring. So I really didn't put much thought into it. And then when I got out, still didn't, because I thought it was pretty clear you're not allowed to travel outside of the country. One, is this country going to allow us out? Two, is the other country going to allow somebody on supervision in? And actually, more so to that point. And so I never explored it. And when you brought it up, I thought, my first thought was, well, this'll be a fun way of being told, no, we can't do something. So I didn't want to get my hopes up.
I remember when I got my passport too, you were like, what? Because you were still not. Because I knew the passport was doable because we wrote an article for it in the newsletter about 4 years ago. And from the research, a passport is a document that has nothing to do with. They don't even ask you
if you have a record. No, they didn't.
Yeah. So.
Which I had no idea that was the case. I thought for sure there would be something about, are you on supervision? Have you been convicted of a felony? None of that. So there was no roadblocks there. And yeah, at the same time, so the initial form that you sent to me, it specifically said TIS or something in relation to your type of sentence. And in talking with DOC or DCC, I couldn't find anybody who knew, did the same process apply to those under the parole sort of law. People always incorrectly call it the old law. It's technically new law.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody knew. And then eventually I was just told, submit a motion for... Essentially, I just created a template from my old pro se, get myself back into court days, where it just looked official, and I kind of just broke down why we wanted to go to Belize, and I took it down to the courthouse. And I was thinking, like, if you hadn't gone through the process, I don't know, probably I wouldn't have even have tried, at least not now, but I wouldn't have known to go downstairs in the courthouse and to the specific window of filing it. And so that made it super easy for me. And like you, with the e-filing system, I don't know that I was told, because I think I had to call, because I didn't hear anything initially. So I don't know if they sent it to my e-file account that didn't exist, but I ended up calling my judge's
clerk, court or something?
Clerk, maybe? Yeah. And they scheduled a hearing for me. So I don't know that had I not done that, I'm sure at some point somebody would have found a way to contact me, because I put my, but I was like, how would they? But
it's my experience, not necessarily.
Right. Because I put my email address and my phone number on the motion, I want to say. Or maybe I put it on the envelope. I can't remember. I remember thinking they didn't contact you, so I need to give them a way for them to contact me. But either way, non-point, because I reached out to them. And then to go, and my hearing was scheduled that same week.
Yeah.
And so,
so funny.
You paved the way from a completely different perspective. And I went there, and the district attorney, I want to say, was the district attorney at your hearing, because the judge asked the DA, did you have any problem with me going outside the country? And he kind of explained a few things, and the district attorney was like, I vaguely remember this before. And then I said,
I vaguely remember this from 2 weeks ago,
right,
when I was sitting right here, completely learning about the case at the table.
Right.
They gave him 10 minutes. They're like, okay, just hurry up and read, because he had no idea what he was doing when he walked into that hearing.
Yeah, and so he didn't have any issue with it, and he granted me the ability to go. And I think he didn't even send a letter to my agent, but had me have my agent call the clerk to confirm.
Oh, they didn't make the agent, because we have the same, anyone watching, right, we have the same agent, and so they didn't make him come?
No.
You know what I mean? That is so, everything was so different.
Yeah, because I remember you told me, like, you were having people come and submit letters, and Now, if I had gone first, maybe they would have made me do the same
thing. Yeah, there's no way to know.
Because we're going together. Because I think I even had it in my motion that you had been approved and I was traveling with you. It's our company. So I'm assuming that's probably why my process was a little bit different outside of yours. Either way, I mean, I was just glad that it got approved.
And so I've forgotten about, because it's one of those things where there were so many, it's kind of like this building. Like if I talk about how we got here, there are so many things and headaches that I've forgotten about that if I'm telling the story of this year of how we got here. But I had forgot that in the process of that, I remember there were, you know, three different hearings I had. And there was the initial one that I was granted, I went to, and the judge is like, do you have these things that I requested? I'm like, I don't. What requested what? Like I was flabbergasted. I'm like, and I'm thinking like she's gonna deny it for sure because I don't have any of the stuff she wanted. And I'm like, I didn't get anything saying what she wanted. I didn't know this because she wanted an explanation as to why I'm going, an itinerary as to like where I'll be at every step of the way during the, which is madness. Like I'm going to a third world country. Like we're lucky if we even, you know, get a transportation from the,
which we'd eventually find out.
Right. Like, and so, and the people that I was organizing it with down there, that was the other side of it, right? Like I'm in the middle of this trying to get approval. I'm also trying to get approval from the guy who runs the prison, you know, who has no reason to approve me. He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't give a crap, right? To even let us come in there. And so he's like, yeah, just come on down and we'll figure it out. I'm like, that's going to go great with the judge, right? Like, I'm just telling the judge, like, the dude said he'll figure it out. We'll figure it out when we go there.
So it's cool, you know?
So I'm having to, like, create this itinerary with little information from exactly what's going to happen when, because I just can't get it. Because, you know, I don't want to keep pushing this prison warden to, like, get me exact dates for stuff, you know, and it's Belize. You know, they're probably like, hey, man, you come down and, you know, we'll just figure it out, right? Which is exactly what we saw. Belize time is a thing. Oh, okay. That not only was it all the things you had to have and all the things that, like, for, you know, me with having the reference letters, but it was like the agency and like, I'm not going to give up. You know, like, that's also not super common, right? Like, we found that so often in life, people just give up on something. It's like, no, this is too much of a headache. And I'm just stubborn as hell. So, like, you know, that was a big part of us getting to this point. But also in that, it may not be a situation where it's so difficult for other people. We were going to Belize to see a prison, right? David Carlson found out at the same time, like secretly, he just posts on social media, I'm going to Britain. I'm like, dude, you didn't say anything this whole time. But I'm like, where is this, bro? Like, you've known very well I'm trying. Right. So he on his own was also pursuing it in a county 4 hours away from us. And he got approved, but he had an internship for his law degree that he was doing in Britain. So like he had a really good reason. If there was if you have a good reason, maybe it's really easy for you, right? Like, so it depends on the judge. It depends on the reason, you know, so it's just so many things, but at least we know the process now that we can then share with folks.
I am curious, is it just for work? I've heard of other people going for like weddings and things like that.
Yeah.
And so, Because I'd like to go back outside the country. I know we talked about Norway or Finland next year. Or even if it's just pure no work related at all.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like to go. Yeah. And is it possible or is it just solely a work thing? Yeah. I don't know.
It seemed so in my case with my judge, it seemed like there was no way it was not going to have to be a legal or an education, or not legal, a job or an education reason. And even if it was job, like she was asking me, she was like, so why are you going? Like, why do you have to be the one to go? Why can't someone else go? Like, so she was definitely making me give answers that showed it couldn't just be some leisure reason, right? So, but again, that was potentially just my judge. Maybe another judge wouldn't be as concerned about that. So the reason Belize became the location was right when it was time for me to say, okay, let's do this. Let's try and see if we can get a travel permit. And test the water, so to speak. And I'm like, okay, where am I going to find someone that has a connection in a country that would be willing to work with us to get there? And so I had like two people that I knew that would potentially have some connections overseas to, you know, make this possible. And so I hit up Brian Kane, who runs Social Purpose Corrections now. And Brian had come here. He was already familiar with me and Adam. I had really, you know, an affinity for both of us because we were able to help him when he came. This is one of these things that I think me and Adam have experienced so many times where we do something for somebody with no goal, no like real strategic reason why we're doing it. It's just like, hey, you know, this could be cool. I think what you're all doing is valuable. And he was able to connect Brian with the jail commander at the time. And I was able to, unbeknownst to Secretary Carr, to sit Brian next to Secretary Carr at our first annual celebration so they could talk. So he could, like, Brian could tell him what they're doing. And so when it came time for me to ask him, you know, hey, do you know anyone in different countries? Because we'd had conversations, so I knew Brian had been to other countries. He was like, yep. He says, I think Belize would be a great option. The guy who runs the prison there, it's the only nonprofit prison in the country. And I think he'd be happy to come show you around. And I'm like, cool. So he just connects me on, you know, WhatsApp. And so here I am just talking on WhatsApp to this prison warden in Belize, right, who's super chill. You know, he texts like you wouldn't expect somebody who's running a prison to text as informally as he did from the very beginning, right? And we had conversations, we'd talk, and from the very beginning, he was like, yep, no, all good. Just let me know when it gets closer and what do you need from me. And I'm not entirely sure if he knew that I had been incarcerated for 17 years and was on paper at the time for a long time. But I think he was. Because I think early on, that was the point of explaining why we're coming, right? Like, the reason why our take on the prison, when you've had people like Brian come, is different because we're actually somebody who's been through it and is on paper. So I'm pretty sure he knew that. And that's why Belize happened, was because, you know, I had a friendly person who was high level that could approve it and make it all happen, right, in Belize. So that, nothing more than that was the reason. It just happened to be really cool that it was a nonprofit. It was like an actual valid thing to go to as well. It wasn't like a complete fabrication of like, let's go see a 3-wheel ambulance somewhere, right, is our whole reason. Like, it was a legitimate whole thing, an ecosystem we were getting access to see. So yeah, I just crazy how that kind of came together as the reason from that one connection.
Did you have a connection to somebody who was off of supervision? No, I guess he still was on supervision. Quit his job, sold his house, then went over to England somewhere, got permission, got over there, and then England wouldn't let him in?
That was Jim. It was Ireland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ireland.
Okay. Yeah, he actually renounced his citizenship in prison. So he got off of paper. Yep. And Jim is not light on research, right? So Jim's the type of person, and he's done a lot of calls and looking into stuff. So he had everything, the embassy in Chicago that he talked to about Ireland, they were all like good to go, got to Ireland, and they told him at the airport, like, Jarrah's back to the U.S. Like, you're not allowed here.
And that's what I kept thinking, because on paper, you have two convicted murderers that are coming to Belize, and I'm like, I know we did our research, and technically there was nothing that we could see online. And I hate to say, yeah, dear Google, can two dirtbags come into the country? Essentially what we did.
Yeah.
And I still remember being on the tarmac, and then we had the weather delay. And so I'm just like, oh, God, just even more time for me to think about how we're going to get denied at customs.
Yeah.
And then we finally get it.
And remember, I did talk to the embassy. So that was the one thing I, because Judge Kais wanted me to make sure that they'd allow me in. Okay. And this was the extent of what I could get. Yeah, I three times I tried to contact them. I emailed, never heard anything back. I actually called and talked to somebody, and I talked to two people. And this is the best answer I could get. Yeah, you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. Sure.
That was all
confidence invoking right there. You're good. You'll probably be all right.
I'm like, okay.
And so I remember being all of us standing there in line, and my heart was pounding, because we're having to fill out this form that certain questions that I don't know what the heck. So I'm relying on Kaylee. Like, what does this mean? Like, what's where are you coming from? Like, we came from Dallas. Was it Dallas?
Yeah.
And then, or am I supposed to put Milwaukee? I'm like, if I put it wrong, I'm going to get interrogated.
Lies.
Yeah. And they're like, are you bringing in any meats? And I'm like, well, I have beef jerky in my bag. I'm like, should I throw this beef jerky away? Does that count? So I'm saying yes. I'm saying my laptop is like $3,000 and there's some limit. I'm like, I'm bringing money into the, I don't know what is going on. It's like, they're not letting us in. I'm convinced. And then I think I wanted to go first. I was like, I just need to get out of the way.
Yeah, you did.
And so let me go.
Yeah.
And so I went, and they didn't ask. They didn't care about anything. And so they're like, yeah, just get away from me, pretty much. And like, well, all right, well, I could have had all sorts of stuff and been fine. And so then I'm watching all you guys come through, and I'm like, well, that was a worry for nothing.
Anticlimactic, yeah.
Yeah. Only to realize that's just the first stage.
Oh,
yeah, we did have another thing, yeah.
Yep. And then it's like, you have to go through all this. And that was a little bit more, they were a little bit more inquisitive about who you are. And I remember them kind of, Amber had said she came with, she might have even said her boyfriend at the time, or friend, I think she said friend. And they gave her kind of, not a hard time, but just, why are you coming with your friend sort of thing. And so, like, I didn't have any issue because I said I'm coming for work. And so I think that to them seemed to make a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
But that was definitely the second leg of that was definitely a little bit more nerve-wracking than the first. Just as a human one, I felt like a blessing because who doesn't want to travel outside the country? Mm-hmm. And so I knew we were coming there from work or for work, but I knew there's going to be times when we could just simply breathe and enjoy the country for what it has to offer, and so I was looking forward to that. I don't know how I really felt though, outside of just happy to be. It didn't really seem real. Mm-hmm. I guess at first, it just it seemed kind of normal. If that makes any odd sort of sense.
For me, the moment that it really hit me, it was a powerful moment when I was running, like it's like 2 or 3 days after we'd been there, and I went running early in the morning, and I'm just running, listening to my playlist. Running through random ass Belize town, right? I have no idea where I'm at. I'm just going down. I'm like, oh, that looks like that turns back to where I'm at. And so going past, you know, the school and people's, you know, houses and just, you know, again, no idea where I'm really going and what's going to happen and who's around here, if this is even legal or if this is like, you know, Crips and Bloods neighborhood and I shouldn't, I have no idea, right? But I remember at some point early on, humid as hell, every day there was insanely humid. And I remember just started getting a little teary-eyed running. Like, this is, you know, I'm running, listening to my playlist in Belize, right? Like, this is really cool. And so that was the moment for me, I think, when it finally hit. Because right when we touched down, I was too busy making fun of the driver and, like, you know, checking into the hotel and hoping that all went right still. And, you know, just, you know, little details I was still wrapped up in. I think the prison visit was the next day. And so, yeah, I was just too much into all of that. And I think it wasn't until after the prison visit when I was running that maybe my mind was a little more able to say, you know, you're actually in another country, right? So, like, this is pretty cool. So that's when it hit for me.
For me, you know, like one of those sorts of moments where you're in the cave, I don't know, in my entire life have I ever felt more, I almost felt like I was being drugged because we were in the cave. There was no light. There was no sound because we were the only ones in there. The water was warm.
The little entrance area was super cool.
Yeah.
Like, that was the first time I had, like, paradise sense.
Correct.
Because up until then, it was like, okay, forest, shanty town, you know, pothole road.
Right.
But then I'm like, damn, this is like some stuff you'd see in a movie.
I still have that one picture of, like, the water looked like an emerald. Mm-hmm. And just, it was, and I know it sounds odd, but almost like an out-of-body experience because I couldn't feel my body. And I was like, this is what peace, you know, we've been running ourselves ragged for years. And just to finally just sit there and be like, oh, I can just breathe. And I remember like, I wish I could bottle this feeling.
Uh-huh. I think you said that.
Yeah. Cause I and I couldn't understand how my body was almost vibrating. It felt so good. And I was like, did one of you guys drug me a bunch of weirdos? And so it was a really cool feeling.
And then, the prison, I think we had driven past it the day before.
Yeah.
Like they had said, that's the prison. Like twice, man. I think we went past it and then back. So we were actually familiar with where it was and got a sense of it. That morning we went, it was, again, like every day, super humid, super warm. And I forget what you were wearing. You didn't have a suit on, though, I believe. Like you had something different. Because you realized over the 2 days, like, I'm not going to look great in a suit. And it's hot as hell. So I think you had something different.
Well, it wasn't even really the heat. It was us driving past the prison, seeing what it looked like, me feeling like I think it actually would be disrespectful to be wearing a suit. And I'll be honest, some of my internal thoughts, just seeing it from the outside, I was a little nervous.
Yeah.
Because you see some of these prisons on some of these shows on Netflix and World's Most Dangerous Prisons, and it had that look from the outside. I was like, well, this is going to be fun. And then when they said the stuff about a woman making you put clothing on, I was like, well, maybe it's not the safest place to come be, but here we go.
And there was a bit of confusion at first, like, who are you? And then I had to say, like, Mr. Murillo, you know, invited us to come and tour the prison. And I think he made a call, and the one, what was his name? The guy that gave us the, well, he wasn't the main guy giving us the tour, but he was like.
We loved it. Michael.
Michael, I think it was Michael, yeah. So then he came, and from then on, he was like, okay, like, this is where you go. So it was really friendly. But yeah, they just invited us up, and we talked to.
Remember you guys thought we were all going to get strip searched?
And, oh, yeah.
Because I thought for sure.
I don't know how it is for you, but strip searches for me are interesting. I've had, I don't know, hundreds of strip searches in the time that I was incarcerated. Every visit, having worked in the visiting room for 2 years, where every single day I got strip searched, and then I'd come back for a visit and get strip searched again. So it was like, you'd think you'd get numb to it. I never got numb to it. I was always like, man, this sucks. So, I think in that moment, it was like, you know, we all thought the same thing. I was like, oh, we're getting strip searched. And I don't remember feeling discomfort. I think I definitely wasn't happy about it, but it was like, hey, this is just the cost of business to get in here. You know, if this is the only time that I have to pull my pants down on this visit, I'll be good. Right? And so.
No, it was, I definitely thought I was going to get searched, but you phrased it right there. My brain was automatically, yeah, if this is the price of admission, it is what it is. For me, the last year of prison, I was on work release, so every single day I had to come back and get strip searched. And yeah, every time it's, maybe there's people that don't care and enjoy it for some sort of deviant reason, but I don't really want to just show everything to some other man. It's just not a comfortable feeling, so it's like, eh. But you kind of get, at least I did, you get numb to it, and you just hope that day they're like, just a pat down sort of thing, right, to hurry up and get it back into the prison,
or the mid level, turn around, yeah. Or you can keep your boxers on. Yeah. Like there's just the different versions of it.
It's like, crazy, right?
Like, right, like that's a win. Like, oh, good, it's a good day. He let me keep my boxers on. Like,
absolutely. Which, yeah, I forgot all about that. There is the, you just drop your pants, and it's like, well, all right, cool. I thought I'd be happy just to be told just to drop your pants. I have to take them off? No, you're good. All right. Well, levels to life and appreciation is perspective.
I don't know if anything was different for me getting in there versus seeing it from the outside. I feel like you could kind of see all the prison on the outside. So I wasn't like, oh, I didn't expect this to be here. It's like, no, this is pretty much in line with what my mind was thinking. The reason I keep mentioning the heat is because I couldn't get over how warm it was. And I couldn't imagine, let me not say I couldn't imagine, I mean, it. You know, you, the
summer.
Yeah, it was just in general, doing your time there. Like, I don't know how it was for the units, but I can't imagine they had any kind of central air. I would, maybe they have fans, but I can't even imagine they had fans in the rooms, right? Like, just something that struck me about that place, that there wasn't personal, like, property like that, where you're getting your own fan. But maybe they did. I don't know. We didn't get to see a cell. So that was something that struck me, I think, throughout the whole trip. Was like, man, to do like 20, 30, some of those guys were in there for a long time. A sentence in this heat, like, man, that is insane. But yeah, that, I think those are the things that stuck out to me was the heat. And then, God, I don't know if there's anything else that stood out initially when I got in there. So I don't know how it was for you.
Very similar. I think I couldn't get over us being in the warden director, because it's a nonprofit's office, and him still having his sunglasses on. I felt like I was in some movie. He was a straight up movie character from Cuba. I don't want to say they both seemed standoffish, because not disrespectful in a way.
Yeah, true.
Until we told them sort of that we were incarcerated for so long, it kind of diverted it and started to go into to the positive way. And to see them sort of shift. And we were just so grateful, I think. And then there was that click. I saw it from Michael first, where then he kind of really started to be helpful.
Yeah.
And just, hey, like, what do you need? It shouldn't surprise me, rather, because here's two people who did 40 years in prison, coming from another country, probably going to be a little skeptical. But I think once they saw our motives were genuine, it was such a shift. And he kind of grow attached to them. At least I did. I started to just be super appreciative for their hospitality, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah, Michael definitely switched. I had forgot about that, because in the beginning, he had a real, I got a prison to watch. I'm not a damn tour guide, but right in the very, like, he's got, like, you know, Mr. Murillo's got me in an office here for this crap. Like, so, but yeah, as I think, I don't know when it was that I remember the shift, but I remember a key point where it was clearly different was when we were walking to that plate, to that one area where, like, they had a speak in front of the class, and we were walking that, like, long, it was past the guy who was working on something, and Mr. Murillo was talking to him, and we were just, me and Michael were talking, and he was just talking about, like, dynamic security and how he bought in over time, and it was like, he clearly is, like, with this whole conversation now instead of just a tour guide mode. So that was interesting. That was later in the day when that had happened. Well, yeah, you're right. He definitely was not feeling it at the beginning at all.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like we were hanging out with our friend, going back the next day.
Yeah, oh, that was such a good feeling. Yeah, that was probably one of my, not to jump ahead, but, because he was like, yeah, just come back tomorrow and pick up the cross that, and I don't know, that cross was sitting on my desk. I don't know why it was so important to have a cross from a faith-based nonprofit. Created by the men that are in prison to come back to our nonprofit faith-based prisoner reintegration organization. So, like, this was made for us, all the, it's not halfway across the world, but from another continent. Pretty important for me to have that. So just to see the smile on his face when he saw us that second day, it was like, man, it was just a few hours that we spent together. It's crazy how you can just almost like this humanize one another. And like, I don't feel like he saw us as criminals or anything like that. No different than he would probably greet somebody who had never been in prison before. So that was really cool to see.
It was definitely a theme for him, though, as he introduced us to his staff and his team, and even other, I think, incarcerated folks there. And he would say this commonly: these two are currently on paper.
Oh, they definitely highlighted that. The length is what, especially the director.
Yeah.
He couldn't get over about the amount of time, or my sentence as a juvenile.
Yeah.
And like, he definitely wanted to showcase, see, you don't got it so bad. So they used us as an example.
You know, I have these moments a lot of times where, as a non-believer, things happen and I'm like, that's pretty coincidental, right? Like, so, like, the only English-speaking country in all of South and Latin America is where we ended up going, which made it massively easier.
Can you imagine?
Right.
Having that barrier there?
That was their first language was English, right? The only country the whole, you know, Southern Hemisphere of the Americas, I guess you call it. And so, yeah, that made it easier for us to have those conversations, you know, those one-offs. And I know I was a little nervous in the wood shop to, like, go and talk to people. Because I didn't know if they'd be like, hey, like, always want to come over. But I really wanted to have some of the one-on-one conversations and see how it really was there. Because you see people that do tours in American prisons, and, like, you're not having a one-on-one conversation with somebody. Like, they're almost massively going to either only let the people they've approved you to talk to, you know, talk to you, or they're going to be right there in the conversation. And to their credit, like, they didn't really chaperone us. We were in that wood shop for a good hour and a half when it was raining.
Yeah.
And they were just letting us walk around, pick up sharp tools, talk to people, like, whatever. Yeah. And so it was interesting to have those conversations and to see how people really felt about the situation there. And, you know, still, who knows if they were really being fully honest. Maybe they felt like we were going to go back to them if they said something, you know. But I think the conversations for me, what I had with them, is that they genuinely felt like they were getting a lot of freedom to be at the wood shop and to create things, and to, you know, kind of rehabilitate or, you know, develop themselves. So there was a sincerity I felt from the people that were there, about opportunities, at least.
And that's when I really started to feel the first difference. Because at the end of the day, right, I have my American perspective on the carceral system. And that's all I have. Even though I've seen other shows, I've read other things, my perspective is this perspective. And it was actually the director, when he would say, like, how young I was when I got sentenced, how much time we have on supervision, to see the looks on those micro expressions of surprise. They're shocked at how much time we have on supervision. That's when I really started to think, so this really is foreign to the rest of the way incarceration works. And that's when I was like, you know, because we get used to, if there's ever, you get used to being on parole for life or parole for 12, 14, however many years you are, And it's like, is this really okay? Because I've kind of, and maybe it's, I've convinced myself that it is okay because it is what it is. And if I go down that path, I'm just going to become angry and embittered. And I don't want to live like that. But just, I can't get over the looks on their faces of, I guess, shock. Like, you're on parole for how long? And even like the director and Michael be like, what? Because we asked him, right, like, what's the average length of, and, but they said like 3 years. It was short. It was less than five was the average length of parole. And you're like, gosh, how is that even possible? And then also when the director kept harping on, he was sentenced to life as a juvenile, and the looks on people's faces. And that's where it really started to bring me back to being sentenced to life in the adult prison system. And like I've told people all the time, I don't even have a problem that I was sentenced to life, but that I was sentenced to live with adults while I was a kid and I couldn't defend myself. And it was those looks on those faces where that's where like, yeah, that's not right. Like, you can't defend yourself. And that was the only time that I kind of emotionally was a little bit uncomfortable, which is an odd sort of way to describe that, because it takes you back to like, yeah, that sucked.
I think one of the areas there that's interesting is from traveling a lot and talking to a lot of folks nationally, I know that we are a significant outlier when it comes to the amount of time that we have in Wisconsin. And so other states either have gone away from that or they never really had it, where it was that much paper that people had. And so when I tell people in America how much time we're having, they're like, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So it's actually more of a like Wisconsin and some other states thing with that amount of time that folks have.
Yeah, so when we went, at least for myself, and I think for you too, Shannon, we were going because it was the only
nonprofit.
The only nonprofit prison in the world. And I didn't know, and I don't think you didn't until we got there, that it was a faith, because we saw these crosses in their logo, like, why is their logo?
I think the thing that struck out first was the Rotary Club.
Yeah, that was actually, yeah.
Because that had a big sign of Rotarians.
Correct, Rotarians. Like, what is that? I honestly thought it was like one of those, you know, those cars on Cuba that you see are super old that just import. I thought, did they import a mural onto the building? About like Rotary?
It's
like,
just random
stuff. So I couldn't understand that. He said, yeah, the Rotarians started this as one of their projects. I'm like, huh, that was interesting. And then when he said faith-based, because I work at a faith-based organization. Yeah, a faith-based nonprofit prison. And I could see, so that's actually the first thing that I noticed that I took away. When we were walking with places, it didn't feel dangerous, and it felt very respectful, and not the forced sort of, I'm gonna say sir to the director because I'm afraid of reprisal. And it was the director seeming to know every single person that he talked to, and that's what, I couldn't get over that. Same with Mike too. Like, he knew everybody.
Yeah.
And when we were in the office and they were talking about different people's families, their cases, like, they knew all of these people's backgrounds. And I was like, I think to the system here, there's no way a ward knows that you exist. There's no way that probably the top five layers know you exist unless something very bad happened or something very good happened. And so going around as we were, you could hear these loudspeakers of religious music, it sounded like. And then he was like, well, we have our own radio station. And then he took us there. I don't know why I felt a sort of a need, because this was like an out-of-body experience. If I'm an inmate there seeing somebody with a camera, two clearly not Belizean people, like, I'm going to feel some sort of way. So like, I told her, well, just tell them that we're praying for them. Like, we know what they're going through to an extent. We hope they're well. And then right away she's like, well, why don't you tell them? And I was like, well, what do you mean?
I was surprised that you were hesitant, because I was like, oh, yeah, Adam talks all the time. We'll do this. So I was kind of surprised that you were like, I don't want to do this.
Because you could, like, every place that we went had that speaker. So, you know, literally the entire prison. And so just to ad lib a sort of interview, like, I wasn't ready for it. And then the director was like, yeah, careful what you ask for. I was like, well, I didn't ask to go on the air. And she's directing me to a seat to have an impromptu breaking news. I was like, oh my God, this is happening. And then I don't know why, but I remember as she's interviewing me, you opening the door and telling Kayla, yeah, I can hear it outside. I was like, oh my God. So that made me even more nervous. And I had this, again, out of body experience where this voice is permeating all throughout the prison of just, what am I hearing?
Yeah.
But it ended up being really cool and really just the ability to tell them that we're praying for them and who we are and why we're here. Just to give people hope in a way to think that, you know, so many things that we never thought possible is possible. So
yeah, we after that we walked to their, I think it was their program area. I think it was that's what the whole building was. And we went into this, again, just never left me, hot ass room that we were in. And these guys are all in desks, you know, and
barefoot.
This guy, yeah. The guy that we first were introduced to had just did his time there.
2 weeks, I want to say he was released, right?
I don't think it was. So he was hired 2 weeks after getting out. I think he had been there at that point for like 6 months, maybe. So yeah, it was really shortly after he was there that he was brought on. But yeah, they hired a person that was just incarcerated to be whatever he was working in the facility
for 2 weeks.
Yeah, but you could tell from talking to him that, you know, he had a different mind state, that they probably were like, you know,
still,
we need this.
Think about it here.
Oh, still, no, absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't matter what your mind state is, right? Yeah, the system's going to, system's going to think you're.
You got some references for Jesus.
Yeah, definitely. And so then, I don't know how it happened, but I think he was just like, I don't know if it was him or Mr. Murillo, whoever it was, like, yeah, you want to speak? And, you know, we're like, yeah, sure. I think I spoke first that time, then you spoke. I think that's how it went.
Yeah.
And just kind of just tell them a bit about our story. And, like, you know, I think in our story is just ingrained hope. And I think we both kind of gave a commentary about, you know, what's possible and, like, to keep your head up in a sense. But yeah, it was, I remember as I was speaking to the group, I was thinking, like, it was one of those where you step out and watch yourself moments.
Absolutely.
Where I'm like, I'm speaking to a class in a prison in Belize right now about my story. Like, that's pretty cool.
That's where my favorite pictures came from, is that classroom. Like, I have goosebumps just thinking about, like, I'm going to have that blown up and framed. That was when we learned from Mr. Murillo that they have prison guards at that prison that were formerly incarcerated. Mm. And I think that for me was probably the number one thing that I left with. Because just think about what that means. And hearing him say, like, I know your background. Like, I don't need to ask for references. I know who you are. And for him to say some of those individuals were some of his best guards, like, he doesn't have to worry about them. And to think about here, where you can't even, if you start to ask people, hey, can I be a prison guard? Like, being in that same prison, you'll get laughed out of. Like, they wouldn't even take you seriously. And, like, he seemed to be very serious the opposite way. Like, I want them to be my prison guards. And I couldn't get over that. And I think that's still, to this day, my biggest takeaway. Because what does that mean? How do they look at you? Because if he's comfortable enough having you as a prison guard, he must see you on some sort of human level that we don't see here, because you can't even get to that conversation here. And so if I had to choose one thing, that was probably my biggest takeaway, like, what comes from that?
Yeah.
Not just the act itself, but what comes from that?
The COs were
And some
I forgot about that. Formally incarcerated.
The POs are the caseworkers, I think when we first heard that, I don't know if we'd ever thought about that, even though right now you have POs, I think, in some cases, who are moonlighting as guards because they need it, but that's a whole different reason. But I think as soon as he said that, I think we both kind of had the same similar reaction in our mind, like, duh.
Right? Who
doesn't know more about this individual coming home and have, like, that made complete sense. And I think the way he spoke about a lot of the things that they did that was different, it wasn't like this, oh yeah, you know, we're trying some different things. It was like, obviously, this is what you should be doing. And when it came to some of those things, like, right away, you bring up to somebody that might be running a system here. But the comment you're going to get, by and large, I imagine, from security staff across the country in regards to that question is, maybe they'll bring things in, or maybe there'll be these issues that you have to worry about, or maybe they have friends inside, right? And so Murillo, I don't think we asked him this, but his response, I'm sure, based off of so many other questions that I asked him and his attitude about like some of these different things would be, then you deal with that when it happens. Like, that, what are we talking about here? You don't just not let things happen because there's a risk. There's a risk in all this stuff, right? So you deal with things as they happen, and you still let the good happen. And then that kind of touched base with what I call the 90-10 rule in the DOC, where the DOC in Wisconsin and in the country, they will prevent the 90% of good that can happen just so they can stop the 10% of malfactors. But those 10% of malfactors, they're still going to find a way to do whatever it is you're trying to do anyways. So you just stop 90% of the good. And so like for him, he was like, yep, like we're not going to let the 10% rule how we operate and give opportunities to the 90%. That was something that, like you just said, stood out for me and his whole attitude about the way he manages the place.
And I think that's probably the fundamental difference there, is that very point. When you get through all the other stuff, that's it right there.
But after everything you just said and what we experienced, if I remember correctly in the ride home,
we still said we would rather be in a U.S. prison.
So what the...
Yeah, and so when you asked me that, I thought about it too. I was like, that is crazy. After all this, I still would rather be in U.S. prison. And I think that tells you a lot about, for me at least, in my, you know, like I think both instinctually, both of us said definitely American prison. But I think the reason for that, for me mainly, that heat was something fierce. Like I can't get over having to do my time in that heat without knowing what they have in their cells.
You also have to think about if you grew up in it, it would be different.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Right, absolutely. But I think there were some amenity factors that just like you could have your own, you could have a radio, you could have a TV on the tablet came later, you could have a TV maybe. But you know, I had to challenge myself, like, how important is that stuff? Like if I'm getting really an opportunity to grow in some cases. But there's also the unknown. Like we still at the end of the day got a tour of what they wanted us to see. So I genuinely still don't know how it would be to be incarcerated there. Is there a level of like gang or violence that you have to worry about? Is there like issues with clothing and bacteria and viruses in the food and like all that stuff that's important for living conditions inside? I don't know how that is, right? I know how it was where I was, and it wasn't bad, right? Like as much as people complain about all the conditions in the Wisconsin prison system, and I can only talk about Wisconsin, it was not bad at all. It was mental, by and large. The time that I was in, it was mental. And so, you know, that's what stood out for me is like, yeah, it was an interesting question when you asked that, and I had to say still the American prison system.
I think definitely I'd rather be in an American prison. And I think you can learn a lot from yourself and others by what you say or do, kind of not thinking about it. So when I got back and people would always ask me, like, how was it? One of the first things out of my mouth, subconsciously, without thinking about it, was we don't have any room to complain about conditions in American prisons. And then, like how you're saying, like you're challenging yourself, was like, am I really that? Because at the end of the day, is it materialistic? Like, would I rather do 10 years in an American prison that was clean-ish and had clean running water, or I'd rather do 2 years in a Belizean prison that was definitely maybe not as clean? Because the one guy was shoveling feces, right? I think it was human feces.
Potentially, yeah, I don't know.
The guards.
Could have been. It wasn't pigs. They had a farm. It was human feces.
Correct, because that's where the guards stayed for like 10 day shifts.
Yeah, that was a trip.
Yeah, I was like, man, guards are staying in the same prison? And I was like, I guess where is that line, right? Kind of conditions on how important is a condition compared to a year? And like, where do you sort of... Because like to me, it wasn't even close. I didn't have to think it that hard. That's I would really, much rather be.
Yeah, it's a really good conversation.
And like, wait, but 10 years?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. At some point, there's a line there, and it's arbitrary for everybody. But just the mere fact that I would say, because here I would do more time than I would there, just by the shock of how much time I did do to them. And so like, how much is it worth to have more comfortable conditions? And like, what does that say about us, right? Because at the end of the day, it's more than conditions. It's about setting myself up for success and not having to recidivate, hurt somebody on the back end. Because that's, at the end of the day, that's what all this is for, right? It, better conditions creates the more likelihood that you won't recidivate. And so am I sacrificing all that too? I would assume that I would be by being here, more comfortable. And it's like, is that the typical American frickin' materialism sort of, I don't know. It really does make you think, though.
I think it's deeper than that, though. I think there's a validity in the American still answer, because he acknowledged several times that they don't have anywhere near the resources he would like to have, right? For the pay that the guards are getting, for the conditions there. I mean, the prison's being built by people that are incarcerated there. Like, they have guard towers that were made off of a picture that he took of the guard towers in Dominican Republic. And they just said, yeah, we can make that. Like, no blueprints. Like, no, like, 3D design, none of that. It's like, yeah, we can make that picture. And they did. And so...
That was crazy.
But a variety of things. Like, they were... The bricklayers and the masons, like, that were in the prison were just making these structures. And, I mean, some of that's cool, because it's like you get the autonomy, the agency to go out and make stuff, use a skill you have, right, not just sit on it. Because in the DOC, you're not making crap, right? Like, you might get a job with maintenance. You might get, to go help with a project here and there, kind of. But you're not hands-on doing your actual skill set. And he was like, hey, if a person comes here and they have a skill set, I let them find some guys and start teaching them. Like, that's super cool and not common at all. But when it comes to America, what I think about is... the conditions that you have are going to significantly influence the path of your rehabilitation. And so I think the key differentiators between the police prison that we saw in America is the treatment, right? As we saw, again, like as we saw, that we you would have to like live there for like a day at least to get a good sense of it as an incarcerated person. But the treatment from staff and the ability to, you know, actually use your skill set or learn a skill set, those are the two key things that were different. Look at America and both of our path. We both were able to actually learn things. And, you know, it wasn't like it's that different. It's just if you can take the treatment, which is not as respectful, that would be one of the key things. And his overall view on, you know, the prison system and what's possible, he was open to things in a way that the DOC in Wisconsin or in the U.S. would not be. But he acknowledged himself that he would like to have more resources to create an environment that is more in line with what the U.S. So it wasn't like he's saying, we're just going to use all our money on like this and the conditions can be like, he realized like this, we would love to have more. So I think it's not separate, the thing they're doing and the conditions. They just didn't have the resources. So they could take that whole setup and bring it to an American prison, which is what Brian, who connected me, is trying to do. He's trying to say, let's take this whole attitude and approach and bring it to an American prison. So I don't think they're separate in a way that seems, you know, irrelevant or just materialistic for us. It's an acknowledgement that the thing he would like to see also there, which is important, they just don't have the resources for. But he's doing all he can without that to make it be different. And I think for me, being able to speak to your like, I don't think they had the apparatus for phone calls like that. I don't remember what the phone calls were, but I don't think they had a strong apparatus for phone calls, you know, every day. And I don't think that the ability to maybe get print material in, like for me, having information come in, like all the things that are part of my journey that I'm now, you know, manifesting in from networking and stuff when I was inside, I don't know if they had that there. So like, that's why I think in our specific journeys, it was very relevant to have better conditions and to have the ability to get stuff and connect with family in a way that I don't think they had right now, the apparatus and infrastructure for. So it's not small necessarily, it's not just materialistic.
I don't think they do time. I think they're up and working all day long.
Yeah.
Every day. I think they have time to sit and read or like sit and wish and wonder, except for sleep time.
And that's another, yeah, so that you that's a very good point. And I also forgot about that, is they're probably not given the real space. Because I was asking him sometimes about that. I was like, what about higher education? What about this and that? And they have like a very clear cut, these are the things we offer, and you better get involved in something, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, if you don't have anything I want, or if I just want to learn, if I want to just study stuff, like, especially for me, that's what my path really was. I quit my work with these jobs after 5 weeks. Like, nobody does that. It doesn't make any sense. And so I did it because I wanted to invest in myself. And I could see it very well being them saying, invest in yourself. This isn't a gap year, you stupid hippie. Like, get a job or go to school, right? So my whole incarceration was kind of like a gap year. Like, that's the way I treated it. I wanted to figure out myself and where to go. And yeah, there wasn't the, but most people aren't going to do that. So like most people are going to have a path or they need some guidance to go. So yeah, it's just, I think for me, it wasn't a small thing. It was a very valid reason why I would still say the American system.
I think for me, my sort of takeaway while we were down there and into today was, I feel that there's a need for us to go explore other places throughout the world through our lens, going with people that are leaders from the government side of things too, the people that run prisons, the people that create prisons. Let's go just see some of these different models through a couple of different lenses. And I think there's some real validity to what could come out of that. So that's sort of what I've taken away from that.
At the end of the day, for me, you're right. Like, I'd love to travel and see more places. But I think the biggest takeaway for me from I think going there was, it confirmed a lot of things I kind of felt. Like, I already felt, this is something that I always thought of in my incarceration, was we, in America, even in Wisconsin, even at this prison, which every prison you're at is always the worst prison. Like, so many guys are like, oh, this is the worst place. And they give you examples of what it was like at this blah, blah, blah. And even then I would always say to myself, and I would say to other people, like, yeah, man, I'm pretty sure we're not anywhere near the worst. Like, we don't, you know, it's, you're just dealing with like things that are inconveniences. And so like that confirmed that for me, that component. But also, I think the sense of, as I've said this before, we created all of this. Everything that we're dealing with in any system in America, it's all man-made, right? So it can all be man undone and man remade. Like, there's no reason that these things actually have to happen the way they do. It's just a certain culture and a certain ideology around security that makes us continue in a sense. And I know there was one guy who we had in one of our panels before, Jim Golombeski. He used to run the Workforce Development Board for Green Bay. And he made a comment about how, and I've thought this, and he voiced this at the panel to the group, to the audience. He said, there's this belief that the system operates in a certain way, and that there's like this understood, you know, this is the way we're going to move, and this is why we're doing it. And he said, what I've found is that it's just a hamster wheel, and everybody's running, just trying to keep it going, and they have no idea why they're doing it, right? Everyone's just lost, just trying to keep the damn thing going, and nobody wants to be the one to get blamed if something stops on the hamster wheel. Mm. And it was kind of like, this is an exact evidence of that, where a place started a whole new prison and had a person take the helm and just said, we're going to have a different culture, right? Like, they just changed GMs. And this year, we're going to have a very passing-focused offense versus in the past, it was very run-based, right? That's all it was. So, like, why can't that? There's no reason that cannot happen here. Like, there's just no excuse to say, this is the way things happen, we can't do it. It's like, eh. Like, we've seen the direct evidence that it's very doable to just change that up.
Adam and I plan to continue visiting other countries to learn about and observe their criminal justice systems. We are currently working on a trip to Germany and the Netherlands this fall, and we will submit to present a panel at South by Southwest next year with the one and only Glenn Martin and Erica Garrity from the Astara Initiative about visiting prisons across the globe. And we would also like to connect with any formerly incarcerated people that have visited prisons internationally to see what they found. So please let us know or connect with us. Thank you for listening. Peace.